Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our first Lunch and Learn for the 2009-10 series. Today's presentation, as a reminder, is being recorded by Illuminate Live, and the recording will be posted to the Research Center website for viewing at a later date for those who wish to do so. It is my great pleasure to hand over the microphone to our presenter today, Dr. Phil Fraser. So welcome, and go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. I want to begin by saying what a thrill it is for me to be here. I'm so pleased to be associated with this university. I was around when it was first proposed as an idea back during the Wally Wirth Commission on the Future of Education in Alberta in 1972, I think. And it was the president of the University of Rutgers at the time, Sam Smith, who said, we need a distance learning educational association institution, probably modeled on the Open Learning Network in Britain. And here we are all of these years later with this highly successful and interesting and satisfying organization, and I'm just thrilled to be part of it. I want to, before I get started, invite all of you folks who are sitting up there in the cheap seats to come down to the table, please, so that we can so I can see your eyes and your faces, and I want to make this as interactive as possible, so feel free to interrupt, to disagree, to stomp and scream, and to ask questions at any point. Don't wait for me to open up for that. Just do it. Oh, thank you. How about Mickey? You can come in here too. This is going to be a rambling presentation, and I thought about the title I proposed, the disintermediation of broadcasting and communication. I immediately had second thoughts and thought, this is so vast a topic that we should design a course, actually, because it could go on for weeks talking about all the elements of how media has gone from something that was highly controlled, highly mediated, with all kinds of gatekeepers and authorities between the producers of content and the consumers of content, that really is a very long, complex subject. So I'm going to skim a bit through it, try to get the highlights, and then I'll get to the real issue of where we are now, and as my grandson likes to say when we tell him stories, what's next? What's next, Grandpa? Where do we go from here? Where we go from here, of course, depends on having some understanding of where we've been and where we came from. And radio broadcasting started with Marconi on Signal Hill in 1919. The first radio station in Canada, CFCF, Canada's first, Canada's finest, the old alma mater radio station in Montreal, went on the air shortly afterward. It was the first radio station in Canada to be on the air. And in the early days of radio, a number of clear channel stations that could broadcast throughout North America, the airwaves were uncluttered, and signals could travel for a very long distance. And right then and there, the key understanding, the key phrase about understanding what's happened in media is that it was described then and there as a scarce public resource. It was a spectrum, airwaves, and it was decided early on by the Airdrie Court in Canada and similar organizations in the States and other parts of the world that this had to be managed in the public interest. We in Canada set up the Canadian Radio Broadcasting Commission at the beginning of the 30s, which was set up, interestingly, by a conservative government led by the Bennett, the Bennett buddies. And I don't think any of you are old enough in the room to remember Alan McPhee's radio programs where he always said, this is brought to you by the Canadian Radio Broadcasting Commission. Which was the predecessor to the CBC, established in 1935 by the Bennett government as a public broadcaster and the controller of those airwaves. Now, some people at the CBC still like to think that they were the first public broadcaster in Canada. Not true. The first public broadcaster in Canada was our own CKUA, which started in 1927 in a little room at the University of Alberta in Corbett Hall with a piano and a couple of microphones. There were no tape recorders or wire recorders. There was live broadcasting, and there were lectures on agricultural matters and various other things. That was the beginning of public broadcasting, and the sort of crowd that would still exist and is still fulfilling an important function. The CBC regulated broadcasting, issued licenses or recommended to the government which licenses would be issued. And in the early days, there was one license essentially per community. They were trying to fight overlap. They talked about the scarcity of channels. It was all AM, not FM. When FM came along, it was seen as something not very useful or important, and radio stations broadcast simultaneously. I was in Timmins, Ontario in 1952, at CKGB, the CKGB AM, and FM. I was in Timmins. Terrible place. couldn't wait to get out of there. So, the CBC, even in those days, was in charge of as more and more licenses were issued to private sector broadcasters, that took a while. First, all the licenses went first to the CBC until they pretty well covered the country. And then gradually, private sector licenses were awarded. And as they grew, they formed associations and started to protest the idea that the CBC was both the regulator and the competitor. So in 1958, shortly after the advent of TV, a lot of pressure came from the few private sector TV stations that were just getting started, saying you can't be our competitor and our regulator. So the Board of Broadcast Governors was created in 1958 to mediate the license to regulate broadcasting in Canada. Again, the watchword was, the airwaves are a scarce public resource. They're owned by the people of Canada, and we have to treat them carefully and with respect. And you can't just spread them around to anyone that wants them. The Board of Broadcast Governors went on for a decade before the Canadian Radio, Television, Telecommunications Commission, CRTC, came into existence. Pierre Junot, he of the Junot Awards, who had been at the CBC as head of the CBC, was the first chair of the CRTC. And the CRTC at the time had vast powers and really did control everything about broadcasting and telecommunications, which was just getting its start from 1968 on. The story that I'm going to unfold is how the CRTC, in those days, absolute power and control, have become increasingly marginalized, in control of less and less, pushed harder and harder to abandon regulation, and to get out of the way of private broadcasting, which has achieved the kind of hegemony that they dreamed of, that they dreamed of in the early days. And that there's a very strong possibility in the years ahead that the CRTC will become virtually irrelevant. It will become a rubber stamp. So here's your license, your stamp of approved, and away you go, do what you like. TV came in 1952. I find it astonishing to say that my broadcasting career, which started in 1951, has allowed me to watch, and in many ways to be part of, the whole development of television in this country. First stations were in Montreal and Toronto in 1952, gradually moved out, gradually saw the development of private stations, CFRN, there is Dr. Rice and others across the country, eventually the development of the CTV, Canadian Television Network, and from day one a serious competition between the CBC and the private sector stations. We Canadians have been since the beginning misused. No, people should stop using the word schizophrenity in this kind of context. We've been of many minds on this subject. There's been no clear national consensus in this country over what government should do and what they should not do. And there's always been in this country a significant minority, 25%, 20%, 15%, as much as a third, depending on the era, who believe passionately, and you're still around, some of you may be part of it, who believe passionately that the government has no business in the broadcasting business, that the CDC should operate like PBS, in the States, and the private broadcasters should be allowed to, in a world of competition, fulfill the public need without hindrance. There's always been a majority of us, however, who believe that public broadcasting has to be the foundation of broadcasting in our country, as it is in many others. And that balance has shifted back and forth, and one of the results of it is that we have never made, in this country as we did in Britain, and did not in the States, we've never made a full commitment to public broadcast. Since the 1930s, pre-television with radio, there was always an argument about how much funding the CBC should get. There have been more commissions, task forces, committees, parliamentary groups investigating this issue, and you could have difficulty finding them all and quantifying them all, because most of them disappeared into the work shortly after their reports are presented. And every one of them talks about stable funding for the CBC. The CBC should be able to plan at least 3 or 4 years ahead and have funding guarantees that it can do that.
See what happens.
In spite of recommendations all along, and that's because of a significant minority that have always had a strong enough voice to prevent Canada from moving in the way that Britain did with the BBC, fully into supporting public broadcasting. We tried. When I was a kid growing up in Montreal, if you had a radio, you had to have a license for it. And it was kind of funny because in those days, all kinds of strange politics, it was almost a franchise to become an inspector to go around and collect the license fees in your neighborhood. And where I lived in Eastern Montreal, as soon as the guy who was collecting election fees was coming around, the word would spread like wildfire. I mean, it's like the internet today. The village, everybody knows everybody's business. And the minute he hit the edge of our community, everybody would know he was coming, and everybody would hide their radios. He'd come along and say, all right, you got a radio? No, we never had a radio. We had an old crystal set down in the basement somewhere. And there was a reluctance to pay up. Hitting is based more on a license fee basis, and television and radio being funded by license fees, we're saying, force and collect, even to this day. So we have this strange bifurcated approach to broadcasting in this country. And for a couple of generations, the public sector really held sway on the basis that, again, the scarce public resource and the need for government management. One of the fascinating things that happened soon after the advent of TV, and in some cases before, because the Americans were on the air with television in the late 40s, a few years ahead of us. And if you lived along the border, if you were in Windsor or Vancouver or a few other cities across the country, you could actually throw an antenna up on the roof and pick up the American signal. And you could watch the famous 3+1, which was ABC, CBS, NBC, plus PBS. It's hardly referred to it in those days. And very soon after Canadian television stations went on the air, very entrepreneurial people across the country started throwing up antennas along the border. In Montreal, there was an antenna at Plattsburgh. And Toronto had one somewhere down around Buffalo or Niagara Falls. And the Asper and Winnipeg and his predecessors had one down along the Manitoba border. And they would put up a powerful antenna, bring the signals in, and they were immediately regulated again. He said, well, cable's not all over the air, it should be regulated, leave us alone. Yet the CRTC and the Board of Broadcast, well, the CBC, actually, at the beginning, said, no, this is still public property, and they're going to regulate you, so you could only bring in the four American stations, ABC, PBS, NBC, and CBS, and you have to carry all of the local channels. So wherever you were, in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Winnipeg, anywhere across the country, local channels, local stations had priority carriage, guaranteed. And then there's space for only the four American channels. Well, the technology advanced. Cable companies that started out the small operations, many of the mom-and-pop operations, many of them local co-ops, we would throw up an antenna and serve, you know, the community. Got bigger and stronger. They started the process. And the other thing the CRTC guaranteed them as a quid pro quo for limiting what they could carry was a local monopoly. So cities like Edmonton were divided up, Montreal, Toronto, others, were divided up into sections. And Edmonton had QCTV on the west side and Shaw TV on the east side. And some of the stories across the country. And the CRTC made it very, very tough on the cable companies as they fought to carry more channels. CRTC said, well, you have to do some community service, You have to have a community center, Channel 10. And that has to be an open access channel for community groups to use this wonderful medium to tell their stories and connect with their folks. So again, the regulator had a lot to say about how you did your business. Wasn't long before Mr. Shaw and Mr. Rogers and Mr. Chagnon and Montreal, City of Toronto, began to see this as a real lucrative business, a real cash cow. This was big dough. And was supported by the banks, they were able to start the process of consolidation, buying up smaller stations. I remember the battle here in Edmonton between Ed Polanski, who ran PCTV, and Mr. Shaw, JR, from JR. You remember that, what was that program, the American program? Dallas. Jim Shaw actually changed his initials, his name officially, his first name to JR. And he'd go around town in the Jaguar with that JR in his license plate. And he saw himself as a mogul, and he became one. And he fought very hard and made a very tough deal with Ed Pulaski, bought him out. And so he had all of that. Mr. Rogers was doing the same in Toronto, and Mr. Chagnon. He was one of the more innovative players in the game. He developed some of the new technologies, some of the multi-channel technologies he was doing that in Montreal. There was, for quite a number of years, a very powerful association of cable operators, Canadian Cable Television Association, which had a lot of money. We had wonderful annual conferences at which you got the latest updates, the most recent investment from the veterans about where the industry, both broadcasting and cable, was going. Skip forward a few years, consolidation is almost complete. Almost all cable companies in Canada are owned either by Shaw or Rogers or the Quebec gang under Vidéo Toronto, which has done some funny things to its name. And three or four years ago, the Canadian Cable Television Association, which ended up being three people, said, why are we spending all of this money and having this big expensive community convention? The three of us can sit down over dinner and decide everything we need to decide. So the Canadian Cable Television Association convention disappeared. It used to be, when I was at Vision TV and beyond, the gathering place for the industry, both broadcasters and cable people, to get up to date with networks and all the things that we do at those events. In 1985, I was a member of the what's known as the Catherine Sauvet Road Task Force on Canadian Broadcasting. We needed the new Broadcasting Act, which was sadly outdated. Marcel Mass, who was the minister under Brian Mulroney, his government, put together a group of citizens led by Jerry Kaplan and Sonia Sauvageau and five others, including me, the token Westerner, to do a thorough investigation of the Canadian broadcasting system and to make recommendations for the new Broadcasting Act. We spent a year and a half of this process. We were willing to develop enormous respect for parliamentarians who commute every week to Ottawa from various parts of the country out on Tuesday, home on Friday, or out on Monday, home on Thursday, and all those terrible trains and waiting rooms and so on. And we worked out of Ottawa for most of the year. We also traveled the country. We went to most of the major centers and held public hearings on the future of Russia. By that time, a new phenomenon had appeared. As the technology advanced and the capacity of cable to carry more and more channels, the evolution of the coaxial cable went ahead. First of all, we saw more and more channels, and more American channels added to the spectrum. And we saw the beginning of the first specialty channels. TSN came along, TV came along, and I'll come back to those. Those were very much on the horizon as we began our work in 1985. We were very public-minded. We still believed that the airwaves, including cable, was in the public domain, was limited, and needed to be regulated. Among our recommendations were that content and carriage would be separated. It can't be a broadcaster and a cable operator at the same time. So we thought that the cable people should be in the carriage business, in the transportation business. They carry signals across the country. And they should stay out of broadcasting. Ted Rogers, whose father was a radio guy, he was in the radio already himself, didn't like that very much. We said, if they want to be in the radio business, the broadcasting and television business, they should have a separate license and operate it as a separate business. We recommended strongly that Channel 10, the cables, community channels, be given more money and more support and more autonomy. Because even then, they're becoming increasingly used as market channels promoting the wares of cable has to offer. We made strong recommendations about educational broadcasting, community broadcasting, and of course, we said the CBC ought to have stable, ongoing financing. I can tell you that by that time, the cable industry was so powerful, in 1986, we reported Committee on the Future, the Task Force on the Future of Canadian Broadcasting. But the cable guys said, we won't do it. Now, Ted Rogers insisted on meeting with us, the Task Force, came to a meeting with us in the room in Ottawa with his buddy Phil Lynn, and was red in the face as he shouted at us and called us a bunch of socialists, communists, and terrible. How dare you interfere with private enterprise in my business? The RTC by that time was in large measure in the thrall of the cable industry. If you looked at the membership of the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission, many of the members came from the cable industry. So, very few from the broadcasting industry, and the government appointees were usually people who favored enterprise over public involvement. And we saw the erosion of regulation, certainly of the cable industry, by the CFTC. Let me give you a very poignant personal example. I was CEO of Vision TV from 1995 to 2001. And the CRTC had decreed that certain channels, Vision TV, Sports Network, a couple of others, were really operating in the public interest and ought to have guaranteed placement on the cable spectrum. So Vision TV had been on Channel 24 across the country for many, many years, since it went on the air in 1988. In the spring of 1996, in Christmas time, 1996-97, I had a phone, between Christmas and New Year's, I had a phone call saying, Rogers is moving you from Channel 24 to Channel 60-something in Ottawa. He said, we can't do that. And they're giving you a month's notice that this is going to happen. So we went to the commission. Turned out that over the holidays, the commission had given a license to City TV, the Toronto station. You know a lot about this. I see you nodding. to have an over-the-air license in Ottawa, which would give them over-the-air channels at first placement on cable. And City TV got a license in Ottawa. They didn't actually have a station there, they just had a transmitter there, which allowed them priority access to the cable system. It made a low channel as opposed to being up in the nosebleed area. Then, from the 60s. And we were going to get bumped. And it turns out that Rogers and City TV went to Fern DeLille, who was in the vice chair of the CRTC over the Christmas holiday, asked for a ruling, got it, and it was a fait accompli. We went to mediation. One of the great regrets of my life is that we didn't take him into court, take out a court injunction to try to stop him, but I don't think we would have made any difference. We went to mediation before the CRTC, who actually would not rule. So we have to go to mediation on this. And finally reached an agreement with Rogers. Ken Englehart, who was Ted Rogers' emissary lawyer, that we would accept this because of the exceptional circumstances of City TV being licensed in Ottawa if they undertook not to do this to us anywhere else in the country. And Ken Englehart left the meeting and said, I think that's a deal. Thank you very much. I think we'll proceed on that basis. And when we came back a few days later, we said, Ted won't buy it. And we did everything we could to change it. Couldn't change it. And in fact, the same Ted Rogers, who was mad personally at all of us, who'd been on the broadcasting task force, took it out on us at Vision TV by a year later, by putting Vision TV in Toronto on the same channel that apartment blocks and condo units and big buildings used so that people could tune to that channel and see who was standing in the lobby. There's a great public outcry. The CRTC took no action. There's a bit of a personal story that I tell it to illustrate how the power of the cable operators over the CRTC was really deeply established by the 1990s. CFEC, the Telecom Development Corporation, and which became Telefilm, also was implicated in this because they ran the Canadian Television Fund. Telefilm Canada, that started out with $10,000 in 1967-68 to boost the Canadian film industry, and that was supposed to be a pub primer. They said Julia Marsh to then the Minister of State for that department. Said, this is a temporary measure. We expect that this $10,000, which we're spending over 3 years, will kickstart the industry, after which it will become self-sustaining. The Canadian movie industry. Didn't work. They kept it alive. They kept having money. But by the time I got to the board of the CRTC they were running about $400 million of your money, tax money, into sustaining film and television in this country, because it, by then it had been proven that you could not profitably make movies or major television series in this country. You needed a government subsidy. And again, the old argument about whether that should be at all, with those saying, no, let them sink or swim, and others saying, we need to do this in the name of national unity and culture, and all of the good things that go with that, meant that there was always a bit of a mixed bag, never a full and complete commitment. So you see that this telefilm also provided substantial funding to Canadian television. No major television program in this country is made without government money. And I'll tell you why. One of the things the CRTC started out to do strongly, which eroded considerably over the years, was to demand of the broadcasters that in return for the privilege of having a broadcast license in a highly profitable business, that they have to give something back and produce Canadian programming, and not just game shows and local news, drama, other forms, long-form documentary, and so on. And they set very strict quotas about how much of this the broadcasters have to produce, and where they have to place it in the schedule, how much of it in prime time. But the reality of the business model of Canadian broadcasting was that the way to produce broadcasting itself, get the most eyeballs, which allows you to sell the most advertising, is to buy American programs, which have already made their money in their own territory, buy them at a severe discount, fraction of the cost of producing them, and put them on the air in prime time. And he actually made his millions doing Love Boat Channel. So you may remember that. Love Boat, wall to wall. So the broadcasters deeply resented having to produce Canadian programming, and you were never willing to put enough money into it to sustain it. They said it's a money leader. And that business model has prevailed, and the CRTC the pressure both from cable really now into big time broadcasting. I'll say more about that in a while. Hey, let me and the great pressure started coming back and eroding the Canadian content and con regulations. So increasingly, television as well as film had to be funded by telephone, later the Canadian Television Fund. And in the recent past, some of you will remember this, the Television Fund was created by putting a levy on cable companies, 5% of the revenue, gross revenues annually, to go into the Canadian Television Fund, which was matched at first by government subvention, a couple hundred thousand dollars, or a couple hundred million dollars. About half of it coming from cable. As cable grew, its their proportion got bigger, And Cable always took the stance, Mr. Shaw, Mr. Rogers, Mr. Sean Young, said, this is private money. So we need to say how this money is spent. And we don't like this money going to CBC and to Access and to public broadcasting in any way, shape, or form. We want this money to go into commercial programming that will compete with the Americans. We want more game shows and so on. And that argument kept getting stronger and stronger to the point where a year or so ago, Mr. Shaw, this is young Mr. Shaw, young Jim, said, we're not going to give you any more money. We're going to cut you off. And because we don't have the say that we want to have in how this money is spent, being spent on these very, very commercial productions that nobody watches, and we lose money by having to put them on the air. So, it was a huge brouhaha. And the government backed down initially. Conrad von Finkelstein, the former judge who became head of the CRTC, said, we'll go to court. And the whole thing got thrown up in the air. And Mr. Shaw was forced to keep putting his money into the pot. And the issue resolved itself sort of by the government stepping in and creating a new fund with the new board, very heavy on cable company representatives, government representatives, very little representation, relatively speaking, from the people who actually make the program, producers and broadcasters. It's still up in the air because we're still fighting this battle today. Meanwhile, in the broadcasting industry, the same thing that would happen earlier on in cable was happening in broadcasting. CBC went on as long as it does, but CTV started buying up smaller stations. Ken West came along as the Astros. The story of Ken West would take a whole other, a remarkable story of how sheer bravado and chutzpah was able to turn the global television network, which started out with a station in Hamilton, Ontario, CHCH, which, by the way, was just abandoned by Ken West and bought by the staff. We were trying to keep it alive. And here they're running wall-to-wall movies. Anyway, the evolution of CAD, of Ken West, into a major third network up to the CBC and CTV, evolved during this period. After Izzy died, his sons, Leonard and David, took over. And during the heady days of the boom, went on a buying spree, bought Southern Broadcasting, which included the Edmonton Journal, the Calgary Herald, all of the best daily newspapers in the country. They bought the Globe and Mail. And it was Toronto's national newspaper. They bought a ton of television stations to the point where they became a really major broadcaster and publisher. And in the heady days of the late lamented boom, they looked like they were doing very well. Thank you very much. CTV, meanwhile, wasn't asleep. They were acquired by Bell Media, Bell Red Media, and they started acquiring specialty channels, TSM and at that time, and many other metrics, including part of the CCD metrics, including a theme, which was part of the CDC at the time, masterminded a lot of that, those acquisitions. At the same time, Dell wanted to be in the delivery business as well, so they started ExpressVue, a satellite delivery system, which is actually the best in the country, competing with Mr. Shaw and Mr. Rogers and Mr. Chang-Yong. So we have now on the broadcasting side, CBC motoring along, so they're trying to get public funding, stable funding. CTV and Bell World Media getting bigger and bigger, and snapping up most of the big discussion channels that are available. The others are in the hands of the Alliance of Scientists. When the Astro Boys got greedy a couple of years ago, they decided they would buy the Alliance of Scientists and have all of those special channels. So they cut a deal with an American financier, Goldman Sachs, who could have been a bunch of them, and recent meltdown on the bailout. And the deal was that Lester put up a pretty small fraction of the money. And Michael McMillan and his partners from the Alliance of Scientists were smiling, and their descendants for generations will smile because of the great deal they got. They got so much money out of this. Paid for the most, most of the money came from Goldman Sachs, an American financier. Now, nobody really believed that Goldman Sachs would put the majority of the money up to do that deal without having some measure of control. The Canadian broadcasting regulations still say that any broadcaster needs to be created substantially, majority owned by Canada. And in this one, with Vision TV, we decided we would acquire a channel in the States. We acquired a license for what is now one Body, Mind, and Spirit channel. And there's a Body, Mind, and Spirit channel in the States, and we thought we should buy it. And that will allow us access to that market. We discovered in that process, I discovered in that process how tricky the regulations were about how much you can own, how much Americans can own, and so on. So there was quite a lot of very tricky negotiations and a very subtle and tricky business. We finally allowed the Astro Boys to meet the test that the new CanWest, which had read the mail and all of the newspapers, which had all of the specialty channels and all of the broadcasters, was really a community controlled company. And the deal was done. And then we had a recession. Advertising went down substantially. Broadcasters were losing money. It's shutting down small stations, and West offered to sell, somebody offered to sell a couple of stations, one in Kitchener and one in Windsor, I think, for a dollar. And Jim Shaw said, okay, I'll buy them for a buck. And he looked at the books and he backed out. And some of those stations, smaller market stations, were being closed down. Because they don't meet the test of the business model. And the Astros saddled with enormous debt, huge debt, most of it offshore of America, have essentially lost control of the money. And it's, they managed to stave off bankruptcy so far. many of us believe that that could be the ultimate solution, and the network is in PSTAT. Somebody will buy the newspapers, maybe. Newspapers don't have a whole lot of value these days. They're having difficulties. The New York Times. The New York Times is in trouble. You know that the newspaper industry is in trouble. Again, it's the advertisers. We'll come to why that is in a minute. So the newspapers. Conrad Blackman, who's the luckiest guy in town, because he stayed as the owner of the National Post and a big part of that network, he would be leading this himself. He's languishing in Florida, and others running back and forth, and he's really saying, he's okay. He's writing another great book. The Asperger's in Detroit. Most of us believe that the newspapers and the specialty channels and the broadcasting channels will be sold off separately. It turns out that the most valuable asset are the specialty channels. Excuse me. Last year, for the first time, specialty channel revenues exceeded those of traditional over-the-air broadcasting. Conventional broadcasters were down to less than half of the revenue in the market. It's worth about $14 million, which is growing because of specialty channel revenue. And conventional broadcasting is in some kind of trouble. So the value of those assets that the Asper boys own is a serious question. Who wants to buy a television station? Who wants to buy a newspaper? Let's see what we can do about buying special machines. Meanwhile, the solution to this, special channels are successful because they get pass-through fees. Pretty amazing system. CRTC devised this in the 80s. Vision TV went on the air about 8 cents per subscriber per month. And that ended up being a fair bit of change. TSN got a dollar for subscribing for that, because they had better lobbyists. And in fact, I remember wearing yet another hat. I was on the Spicer Commission in the early 1990s, 1991. Citizens Committee on Canada's Future. We read the Globe and Mail this morning. There was Keith Spicer, who was the head of that group of 12. Writing an editorial about his days as the first Canadian Language Commission appointed by Pierre Trudeau. He's still a little bit crazy and very feisty. And I remember TSN, to me, again, about public ratings and liquid broadcasting, among other things. I remember TSN coming to us and saying, "Gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, sport is culture." And we stifled the laugh. Anyway, they specialty channels early on got guaranteed channel placement and pass-through fees that eventually became very lucrative. I won't tell you the story about the specialty channel I applied for with the film board, but failed in time over a drink. It's a great story. So specialty channels had not only fees which the cable companies had to give them per subscriber, they also had advertising and any other money they could pick up in various ways. And they were the first to develop websites, which is what this is really all about, we'll come to that, and became the most valuable properties. Well, now they are stronger than broadcasters. Broadcasters, of course, are all own specialty channels. and they're hedging their bets. And Bell's World Media is hedging it two different ways. They've got CTV television network, they've got a bunch of specialty channels led by the very lucrative TSN, and they've got ExpressVPN, the satellite service. So the broadcasters, conventional broadcasters, CanWest, the TVA, which is a private broadcast in Quebec, and CBC joined in, CTV, said we're facing declining revenues, advertising is going down, we're in deep doo-doo. We want pass-through fees, which they've never had before. We want X per subscriber per month from the cable company. Well, Mr. Shaw and Mr. Rogers went ballistic. Said, no way, no way, we'll fight it in court. We won't do it. And if we have to do it, we'll just pass it on to the consumer. That's no big news, they do that anyway. And the CRTC, conflicted as it is, dithered, wouldn't come up with a ruling. The fight was going on, both sides, threatening lawsuits, raising huge campaigns, to sell full page ads with, you know, pitched from one side or the other, you know, why they needed this. And Bell, fighting itself, because it's on all sides of the issue. So here's Bell expressly saying, no way over our dead body will you ever pass through fees from us. So CTV eating it. ESL is saying, we can't survive without them. So the mediation that we used to have in Canadian broadcasting, you can see, is eroding at a very great rate. And the last word on this from the CRTC, reinforced just this past week, was, well, we think there ought to be a pass-through fee that you're going to have to negotiate, we will say. So the fight is on. The usual broadcasters, especially CTV, TVA, and CanWest are arguing that they should have access to this, and the cable guys and the satellite guys are saying, no way. And the CRTC has folded its arms and said, well, we think it ought to happen, and we're prepared to mandate that there be pass-through fees, but we won't set the fees. So you figure it out. Some kind of mediation. The CRTC does a number of other things. Some of us here are thankful that they're still doing it. The premise has been, going back to the old idea of scarce public resource, that any time a broadcaster or a cable company does a deal with advances their business, they have to pay something. They have to pay benefits to the industry or to some good public cause. So benefits packages could include, you know, money for the Back Television Festival, money for training facilities, money for community programming, the vast range and stations, radio and television come up in incredibly creative ways, including on the board of the Balance, which is a highly popular radio station in Edmonton, who were acquired, were created by station in Toronto, 492.5, which is the original urban music station in Canada. I'm on their board, small disclaimer. And they created the Bounce in Edmonton for standard broadcasting. And part of the deal was the Bounce, and I chair this committee, produces scholarships for students every year, some of which go to Northwest, some of which go to Mates, some of which go to Grant McEwen. And we pay the money, and it's now because we got the license. most recently. When I was at Vision TV, Moses made it to Creative City TV, one of the great innovators in Canadian broadcasting. Always wanted to have some piece of Vision TV, but Vision TV was set up as a not-for-profit charity. It could not be sold. No shareholders, no shares. It was a not-for-profit charity. Sorry. There's nothing to buy, nothing to sell. When I retired at the end of 2000, beginning of 2001, my successor found a way to roll the three new channels that we had acquired when I was there from the CRTC. I had a very special suit I used to wear up there. Every time I went for that suit, I got a license. not this one. we got a license for one. The 99 and Spirit channel. We had a license for the Christian channel because they were putting all those American evangelists into one pot and taking their money. And another one, which was done as a joint venture with the Montreal Jazz Festival, had an inspirational music channel. Well, my successor at Vision TV managed to roll those all, and they were all set up as for-profit enterprises, the profits of which were to feed Vision TV. Through some very clever Gary Newman, Bill Roberts managed to create a corporate entity that could be sold. So just quite recently, Moses Nyman, who's been laying back, Google him sometime back in the year, been laying in the weeds waiting for something like this to happen, cut a deal. And he is now acquiring Vision TV and the other channels. He already has acquired, I don't know how you do this, but it used to be the Canadian Association of Retired Persons, CARP. He's also part of his empire. He produces a magazine called Zoomer, which is a lifestyle magazine for old folks like me. It's highly successful. So, here's where we come in. CARP and Vision TV and Moses, I think it would be a very good idea, and they proposed this to the CIPC, if they have an association with an institution that could offer special design and appropriate learning for seniors. So, small world. Ross Mayard, who was with me at Access a bazillion years ago, calls up and says, listen, buddy, you want to put together this benefits package, you've got $190,000, and how about after asking getting that money, and have you got any courses of interest to seniors? Well, yes, we have, said Evelyn, and he sent them some stuff, some information, some background, and that's in the proposal. That may be the last gasp of the CIPC in mandating benefits. I'm a bit of two minds about it, but we'll take the money, and we will be back to some wonderful programs.
Okay.
I want to make some time for questions. What's next? Jeez, I've got pages of notes. You can fill in the blanks pretty easily. What has driven all of this is the internet. Recent survey said that 80% or so of Canadians want to be able to get through media any which way they can, every which way. They want it on their cell phones, they want it on their computers, they want it on their TVs, they want it on the who knows what. There's no business model for this. In self-defense, every broadcaster, every newspaper, every media outlet has created sometimes extraordinarily elaborate websites, and they're just a drain on their finances. They haven't figured out how to monetize it. A certain amount of advertising is not enough. Although the advertising that's abandoned conventional broadcasting has gone essentially to the internet. that's still sorting itself out. If we see in this, the internet represents the ultimate end to mediation by government or industry groups or powerful forces in trying to control who gets what and how they take care of their goals. The total disintermediation of broadcasting and media is standing on our toes. People are still trying to figure out how to survive, newspapers, television stations. What's next? And my grandson says there'll be a total global future. It's impossible to regulate the views of people that found as Hollywood is trying to control your product. There's serious copyright issues involved. Some of you will be concerned about that. Anyone who's creative, whatever you create, at some point it'll end up on the internet, available to anybody in the world. And how do you pay? And if creating stuff is your bread and butter, and you can't get bread and butter, why would you go on doing it? How does that sustain itself? If newspapers are supplanted by all kinds of websites and blogs and MySpaces and YouTubes that have every conceivable story you can imagine with no analysis, and newspapers haven't got the revenue to go out and generate content, what's going to happen? It's unregulatable. Add in time shifting, podcasting, and watching the U.S. Open tennis championships right now. My dual recorder, my Express View set is recording the match, and I'll watch it. I'll skip through the commercials and the boring bits, and there goes another stretch of revenue. So, monetizing creativity, monetizing the products of creativity, is the next great challenge. And we haven't figured it out. And I think that people in universities should be at the forefront of trying to figure it out. At least be part of the process. I will finish by saying that there's an opportunity for Athabasca University in all of this mess. Besides the Tableton Net Convention being held, last year the Canadian Association of Broadcasting did not have a convention. It was another of the great gathering places where the latest information and expertise was on display. So there's a vacuum here. There is no annual gathering in Canada now which brings together all of the aspects, all of the elements of broadcasting and telecommunications to bring people up to date. At least people do bits of it across the country. And I think, some of us think, that Athabasca University, in collaboration with the Canadian Association of Broadcasters and others, could fill that vacuum and could bring academic rigor to having an annual situation report on what's next. So, voila. Do you have time for questions? Mm-hmm. I can't believe I talked so long and I didn't say that much. So, any questions, comments, rebuttals? Yes, hey. There'll be a few of those. I can't remember which one you're talking about. But it's about how big the crisis is associated. Threats are getting bigger. Americans are putting fiber to the warfare. The other technologies getting the anti-pressure technologies that are making the threats bigger and better. The telcos are now heavily marketing air cards which allow you to connect your computer to the net, not through Wi-Fi, but through air system. It's crazy for you. I'm trying to get a lot of money for it. Sorry, go ahead. Okay, the question is about the delivery system being overwhelmed by the amount of content. My take is that it's almost a leapfrog in terms of situation. The pipes will get bigger. They are getting bigger. The content will keep growing. And you're right, there'll be more than one, there'll be many kinds of pipes. There need to be many kinds of delivery systems to spread this stuff. But I'm pretty confident my grandson shows up with his iPhone and shows me stuff that like my father would have thought was the work of the devil. And maybe it is. And it's amazing what the carrying capacity of that system is. Or the telephone mechanism. So my answer to the question is not sensitive. But kind of if you build it for the current situation, the pipes will get bigger, the delivery systems will get better. If you read Valet and some other magazines, you can go to sites on the net and see that people are staying up much to be able to do that. I don't have a definitive answer on this.
No, I was just curious if you were talking about the
quality of the content and the way you have to make sure that
the I think you need to be talking about reverse of this current technology.
Okay.
That's correct. Right. Unfortunately, that word is saying should be enforced through every content producer in the world, specifically members of the NCAA and the AA, which has been taking and talked about.
We're dragging our feet in Canada. The Americans were forced to give up analog broadcasting. Mm-hmm. It has happened. The deadline has passed. So all television stations in the States are now digital. This is not a technological process. That bandwidth, the spectrum that was given up by analog television is now being sold at high price to only people who want it for various reasons, including telephone companies and cell phones and so on. We are a couple of years behind them. Some of our stations have gone that way. I'm not aware of any terrestrial station in Canada that has yet gone digital. There is a deadline. I can't remember exactly what it is. Sometime in the next 3 months, when it's mandated that they will. The other incredible discussion is whether some people find this. See, this is a solution. We just shut down the over-the-air antennas. Various studies say that very few people actually watch television, television. 5, 6, 7%. Because everybody is connected to cable one way or another, and gets television through a satellite or through some pipe or other across the country. I remember at one point there was an argument made that the CBC would be way ahead if it shut down all of its over-the-air transmitters and gave anybody who didn't have satellite a free set. Just gave them it some for nothing. It saved them a great amount of money. It hasn't happened. Short answer to the question is we're behind the curve in Canada. Still up in the air. Yes.
So I want to ask you about the next thing that I think is sustainability and how you can do it. You said, my son-in-law, that one more company, which is a Japanese company, said that they're giving away advertising in print form in Twitter. They actually put Twitter messages out on their about their products in such a way that they can capture what they want to say that they're unemployed with. Is this a serious threat to the advertising that means that for the broadcasters, especially
for people,
where they have
a future? Well, it's pretty simple. If you can deliver eyeballs, you'll get the advertising. So whoever can figure out ways of getting lots of eyeballs will win that. We've almost seen, others in the room may want to comment on this, we've almost seen the rise and fall of Twitter, where it came on like gangbusters, everybody was doing it, and a lot of people are saying, there's an ad on television, put up by one of the phone companies, I think, which has a family situation, and they were saying, "Mom, I'm back at school now. You don't have to put I love you on my Facebook." And Dad is sitting on the couch, twittering. I'm sitting on the couch, and the kid says, "I don't need this information." sometimes it's just too much information. And I think Twitter's experiencing that already. Short life, fairly short life. Who knows what's next? There are other ways of delivering advertising. This is well, free paper. Really, sorry. In Japan, and pretty soon the rest of the world, will be able to use this to make money out of the bank machine, buy a can of pop, walk by a store and see what's on sale, and that's a way of pushing advertising. So I'm not sure how that's going to roll out. Others may have some comments on this, I hope, but I think this is. I think ultimately my gut feeling is that this toy is going to become so important in our lives. It's going to be a lifeline. It's already there for me, I think. And my turn, even my first feeling is, put away your BlackBerry. I don't want to see it going yet. So, a lot of advertising will be designed to get to you through this. You know, they talk about advertising designed so you walk by a store. I mean, you're already in some places, not here, but places I've been, you walk by a store and you hear a loudspeaker talking to you. You know, you got this or that. We're showing you a picture of something just as you walk by. And it'll know that you're male, young or old, or female, young or old, then the message will be pitched to that. And it's going to get more sophisticated as we go along. Okay? You know what? Yes? Well, it's marketing. Somebody has to create the content. Somebody has to create the knowledge. And universities are in that business. So we expect that universities put more resources into creating research, intellect, useful intelligence, and distributing it through the net. You know, it is the old cliche of the global village. I lived in Montreal and standing on all the formalists. And as a kid, if I went out and did something wrong around the neighborhood, by the time I got home, my mother already knew about it. She was right. everybody knew everybody else's business. There were no secrets. And it's true now globally. There are no secrets. You can't get away with anything. You do something wrong, somebody will be there and this does video, right? And then it'll show up on TV or YouTube or somewhere. And we've seen some remarkable instances of that, of course. Yes, sir.
And my question is what I have done well, this is one of the things that we're experiencing the broadcasting community for education is that completely redefining the things that deal with experts, general population or specialist amateurs, defining which probably takes anyway, but that we feel this whole notion of, anybody now with, a cell phone or an internet connection with, some other network, community affairs or military messages or something like that. And what reminds me of actually is the barrier to use radio when it's basically a two-way communication that is left in the field. And the airwaves was qualified very fast to contain the shipping. And sometimes the radiation is even so, you can feel all of us have to get inundated by non-stop messaging, most of the important kinds of issues that occur. And I'm wondering if this is a new cycle of people that sort of technological boom or something.
We absolutely agree. It's changing the way we learn. The way we create, and the same in the way we teach. We all grew up in a system where you learn by rote. Gives us information, absorb it, regurgitate it. Thank you very much. You get an A if you can remember all of it, so on. Now, people are learning what they need to know is how to learn, how to use the vast resources at our fingertips. You know, I'm writing books when I'm not doing this. And if I'm not directly connected to the net where I'm doing it, I'm feeling severely deprived because I'm writing this. What was that date again? I have a key on my computer that now connects me directly to the new Microsoft. Search engine
thing,
yeah. I keep bring. Which is not so far. And I hit Bling and I say, what was the date of that event? And this correct spelling of that guy's name. So on, and then back and forth. It's just, I believe it on. And writing this book is my third book. The first book, I spent hours and hours in the Edmonton Public Library. Haven't been in the library for 2 years. Just go online. Not only find and have learned to assess how valuable or accurate some resources are, but find links that lead me to other things that I would never have thought of. And, half a dozen times in the past 6 months, I've found in some reference a book that I never heard of. And I immediately go to Amazon and order the book, and they find it. Some little guy or girl somewhere in some little place has a little bookstore, and they've got 3 used copies. And in about 3 or 4 days, it's in my mailbox. Astonishing. So, you're absolutely right. Too much information. The educators today need to know how to deal with that, how to parse it, how to decide what's good and what's not, and how to navigate your way through this tremendous information overload, which is the greatest blessing and the greatest curse of our time. Is that a good line? So, thank you all very much. It's been, I hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you got a little bit out of it.
Thank you.
You recorded it.